I'd done what they needed to do, and here would sit in my class, and I was not even given books as to teach because the program was that new. So we started with taking Reader's Digest, passed around Reader's Digest, sounding out words, talking about what a verb was, what a noun was. And one day I wrote on the board, I says, we're going to talk about conjugation. Oh boy. I got a lot of funny looks on that one. And when they learned, no, we're going to conjugate verbs, kind of a relief went through the room. But it was kind of a funny, there were a lot of funny moments, but we had a good time. And they all graduated successfully. They all ended up going through the military, finally going back to the U.S. The war ended, and they speak English to this day, as far as I know, very well. When you look back at life, I realize that these young men had all gone on, and I'm sure they've been great citizens and learned English and had great lives. But this was the beginning process for me, because the teacher always learns more than the students learn from the teacher. And I realized I had had to begin to take what talents I had and use them in a field that I never had. I wasn't trained to be a teacher. I was a journalist, but I was using my talents in different ways than I had ever imagined. It was a great beginning and really taught me that I could do things that I didn't even know I knew I could do.
On that note, Nancy Cole Silverman, we will be sure to talk again.
Thank you.
This is John Crumshaw for KPFK, Politics or Pedagogy. Please make your contribution online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. Norman Solomon, Director of Roots Action and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of the book War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, wrote in his most recent op-ed that while many of the headlines following the Harris-Trump debate declared Harris the winner, and while this is good news for people understandably eager for Trump to be defeated, that when considering Harris's comments on Gaza and overall the little mention of Gaza, her debate performance was a moral and political tragedy. The war in Gaza, which is now in its 11th month and has claimed the lives of at least 41,000 Palestinians, has triggered protests across the United States and around the world. And as documented in a new report released by the University Network for Human Rights, a consortium of human rights centers at colleges across the world, quote, Israel has committed genocidal acts, namely killing, seriously harming, and inflicting conditions of life calculated and intended to bring about the physical destruction of Palestinians in Gaza, end quote. And polls of the American voting population show that the majority of voters support ending U.S. arms transfers to Israel, and support for an arms embargo is growing. A June poll from CBS showed 61% of all Americans said the U.S. should not send weapons to Israel, including 77% of Democrats and nearly 40% of Republicans. And these poll results have been consistent for months. Now, despite the popularity of cutting Israel off from American weapons, the Biden-Harris administration has continued to pump billions in military aid, including thousands of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel, approving a $20 billion weapons package just last month. The Biden-Harris administration has ignored calls from Democratic senators to halt aid, as well as credible evidence of human rights violations committed by the Israeli military. Biden briefly halted transfer of munitions in May as Israel prepared for an offensive in the Rafah where 1 million Palestinians had sought refuge, but later reversed his position after pressure from the pro-Israel lobby within the party. At the Democratic National Convention, party officials denied a main stage speaker slot for more than 200 uncommitted delegates and ceasefire delegates committed to Harris who are in favor of an arms embargo. And Harris made clear in the debate that while she now backs a ceasefire, since the first 6 months the Biden-Harris administration actually refused to call for a ceasefire, she simultaneously is still standing firm in her pledge to continue to arm Israel. And as Norman Solomon states in his op-ed, what Kamala Harris and Donald Trump said about Israel and Gaza in their debate was predictable. And so, too, was what they absolutely would not say, with silences speaking loudest of all. With us today to talk about what little attention Gaza did receive at the debate, how Harris and Trump's stance on Gaza impacts each candidate's presidential run, and what Trump and Harris didn't say about Gaza in the debate, is our guest, Norman Solomon, the National Director of RootsAction.org and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His latest book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, was published in paperback just this last week with a new afterword about the Gaza War. Welcome to Middle East in Focus, Norman Solomon.
Thank you very much. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you great. And again, really, really happy you could join us today and for us to have hopefully a very robust conversation about the Harris-Trump debate as it relates to the situation in Gaza. In your op-ed, which I really appreciated, you state that while Harris won the debate, as I mentioned in my opening, in the eyes of those understandably eager for Trump to be defeated, Harris's performance was a moral and political tragedy. Can you explain in your own words why her, as you state, performance was a moral and political tragedy?
Morally, it's a disaster for the continuation of what is a mass murder in Gaza. And when we step back from all of ideologies, nationalities, and so forth, we see just empirical evidence, mostly children and women being killed by the Israeli military that is armed, and its war made possible by the U.S. government's massive military assistance, bombs, weapons, ammunition, and so forth. So at a moral level, to continue to support the pipeline of weapons to the Israeli military, the so-called Israel Defense Forces, is a moral tragedy and serving really as an accomplice to mass murder and what Human Rights Watch leaders and others call genocide. And then if we move ahead and look to, if we want, or move at least to a different realm, the political level, there are very clear surveys by some of the most reputable pollsters in the country that a large majority of voters want a cutoff of weapons to Israel as long as the war on Gaza continues. So it's really a double whammy. It's inexcusable. And yet it is the policy that Harris is pursuing.
So on that point, can you elaborate on why Harris calling for a ceasefire then is just simply not enough?
Well, calling for a ceasefire has become a facile activity by the Biden administration for many, many months. And as I chronicle in the afterword to War Made Invisible, President Biden was doing photo ops back last winter saying, we think we're very close to having a ceasefire. We would have fallen off a turnip truck to believe that a ceasefire is imminent as long as the U.S. insists on continuing to fully arm the Israeli military. It's very clear that the Netanyahu regime has no interest at all in a ceasefire. And as I write in the book, the concerns that have emanated from and been voiced by top Biden administration officials about the killing in Gaza, the use of starvation as a weapon of war, the blockage of medical supplies and necessities to get into Gaza to a very large extent, it has been treated as a public relations problem, not a problem of humanity and humanitarian disaster. And what I get into in the book is that we may have the impression that what's happening in Gaza now in its 12th month is fully covered by the U.S. media, that we're really getting a sense of what is involved for people in Gaza. In practice, we don't have a clue if we depend on U.S. mass media for two fundamental reasons. One is that media themselves, the screens, the audio, what we get on our devices, television, radio, and so forth, it's incapable of really conveying, even if the journalists are doing their damnedest, incapable of conveying what it's really like to be in a war zone and certainly what it's like to be in the hell of Gaza that is now almost 1 year along. The other factor is about bias and the ways in which religious, ethnic, nationalistic, cultural, and racial biases are affecting what kind of coverage we get. Not so much the quantity, because there's been a lot of quantity of sorts of the Gaza war coverage, but the kind of coverage, the empathy, the emphasis, the connection with human beings. And so whereas those who have suffered from the horrible Russian invasion and attack on Ukraine for more than 2 years have had tremendously empathetic coverage in U.S. media, whereas that has been relatively sparse in U.S. media coverage of Gaza. And one more point I would make, that to the extent there has been coverage in U.S. media of the suffering in Gaza due to the U.S. armed Israeli military's daily attacks, it's been a paradigm of commiseration about and compassionate coverage of victims without victimizers. And so to some extent, there will be mention that, yes, the Netanyahu government is proceeding to continue with the killing. But the key reality, really, in terms of what makes all this possible, is the shipment of arms recently, another $20 billion with a B dollars worth, green-lighted by the White House, supported by Congress. Washington, D.C. is the core of where the victimizers are ruling. And these are people who talk about, and I'll sort of sum up here, Secretary of State Blinken, President Biden, they talk about a rules-based order. What they mean is we make the rules and we break the rules. So in the media coverage, the victims without victimizers sometimes encourage compassion, but a focus on the victimizers in Washington, D.C., that's almost never coming across media coverage.
Wow, such a powerful point, actually. This idea that, you know, what we see within the media coverage as it relates to Gaza, specifically in this time that we're all witnessing in real time, but also just even in general regarding the suffering of Palestinians at the hands of Israeli apartheid, Israeli occupation, all supported and funded by the United States, is the fact that you might see the victimization, but you're not seeing who the victimizers are, and specifically as it relates to Washington. Such a powerful point. And I wanna focus in on that, actually, and bring it back to the debate, the Harris-Trump debate. You know, one of the things that you spoke about in your op-ed and that you're actually highlighting right now is just the, you know, there's what's said about what's happening in Gaza, but then there's also the things that are not said. And to your point, one of the things that are not talked about, whether it's in media coverage, whether it's in political discourse, whether it was within the debate, is who the victimizers are. And then and how that relates to U.S. policy and politicians. Can you talk about and elaborate on one of the things you mentioned in your op-ed, which is this idea that it was predictable what both Harris and Trump said in the debate, but it was actually also predictable what they did not say.
What they did not say was the real history of Palestine since the 1940s. And in terms of the debate, when Donald Trump, and in previous statements, which he implied but has said point blank in the past. Trump has said that the Israeli government should, quote, finish the job, which is really an encouragement to complete the genocide and the mass murder that's underway. In terms of what isn't said, what was not said, and as you mentioned, predictably not said in the debate, has to do with that history did not begin on October 7th. And I think we should be clear. What Hamas did on October 7th was horrible. It was a series of war crimes. It should be condemned. Those were atrocities on October 7th. Every day since then, the Israeli government has engaged in atrocities in Gaza. And in terms of, if we're going to look at numbers rather than 1,200, we're talking about documented 40,000 people killed in atrocities and many thousands more under the rubble and no intention to stop. So what's left out of the what passes for political debate and discourse was certainly what was left out in the Harris-Trump debate, is that since the displacement of Palestinian people in 1948, the emergence of the apartheid state that calls itself Israel is one that is a fundamental violation of human rights. And so we have this kind of Orwellian willingness, even eagerness, by U.S. mass media and national political figures, with very few exceptions, Rashida Tlaib being one of them. But with those rare exceptions, it's a refusal to acknowledge history and a refusal to maintain a single standard of human rights. And when there is an Orwellian eagerness to put certain announced precepts on a shelf and out of sight when not convenient, then we have an Orwellian world. We have a process of dealing with the U.S.-Israeli alliance, which has, even in normal times, involved a 10-year pact for $38 billion with a B dollars of military aid over a 10-year period. We're dealing with tacit and fundamental attitudes that, again, were not in any way acknowledged in the debate, that not the rhetoric but the reality of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and vis-a-vis Israel and Palestinians is that some lives really matter and some lives really don't. What I call in the book, two tiers of grief, two levels of acknowledgement of human grief mattering. And so to sort of sum up, the unacknowledged, hidden in plain sight attitude of the political elites running the U.S. government is that Israeli Jewish lives really, really matter and Palestinian lives really, really don't. And that kind of policy, that kind of attitude is fundamentally repugnant, and we should completely reject and challenge it.
And for those who didn't watch the debate, can you maybe recap as best you can, what did Kamala Harris say with respect to the situation in Gaza, and then what did Trump say?
Well, in terms of what Harris said, it was kind of a tape loop. It was a version of what she said on a few occasions since she got onto the ticket, including in her convention speech. She started out, when asked about policy towards Israel and the Gaza war, her very first words were, "Let's first talk about how we got here." And so she put a stake in the ground from the outset, saying that we got here, meaning the Gaza war, on October 7th. Well, yes, it was a catalyst. But what she did not acknowledge is that there have been decade after decade before that, where Noam Chomsky and others have rightly called Gaza the biggest open-air prison in the world. And this has been going on for so many years, into decades. And by not acknowledging that, by omission, it was a powerful form of propaganda. Then she went on to a kind of a standard sing-song that Israel has a right to defend itself, as though what Israel is doing in Gaza has anything to do with defending itself. And then she went on to that she has a complete commitment to supporting and defending Israel. And then she went into the sort of gloss of humanitarianism that too many people, civilians, have died in Gaza, and a ceasefire has to happen immediately. And that's one of these preposterous things about what she said. On the one hand, she's saying there should immediately be a ceasefire. On the other hand, she's saying that she supports continued sending of weapons to Israel to make, under these circumstances, a ceasefire impossible in practical terms. So that's where she's coming from and how she pitched her line on Israel and Gaza. Donald Trump, when you can figure out even what he's trying to say, basically says, you go on, Israel, and do it because I completely support you. And of course, this is this braggadocio, if that's the word, attitude that in the White House, he would again end all wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and in the cosmos. But, you know, he always makes stuff up. But as I referred to before, he basically has said publicly that Israel should do what it wants to, quote, finish the job. So as hard as it is to sort of sum up, hard as it is to imagine, a Trump presidency would be even worse for Palestinians than a Harris presidency. And a Harris presidency, as it seems to be foreshadowing a continuation of the Biden policy towards Israel, would be terrible. And as always, people at the grassroots will need to organize nonviolently, emphatically, and militantly to demand that this genocide end and that the apartheid system in Israel be ended and the U.S. finally stop supporting it.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking today about what little attention Gaza did receive at the Harris-Trump debate, how Harris and Trump's stance on Gaza impacts each candidate's presidential run, and what Trump and Harris didn't say about Gaza in the debate, with our guest Norman Solomon, the National Director of RootsAction.org and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His latest book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, was published in paperback this past week with a new afterword about the Gaza war. So, you know, I want to get to now how Harris's stance on Gaza could actually impact her presidential run. And, you know, as I mentioned in the opening, a June poll from CBS showed 61% of all Americans said the U.S. should not send weapons to Israel, including 77% of Democrats and nearly 40% of Republicans. And these poll results have been pretty consistent for months. Can you talk about how Harris's stance and well, let's start with Harris, how Harris's stance on the war in Gaza could and will impact her presidential run?
Well, as you mentioned, the polling has been consistent in terms of many months. National polling, most people want a cutoff of, they want essentially an arms embargo towards Israel from the United States. More specifically, the polling in swing states, several swing states were polled by YouGov, one of the preeminent pollsters, earlier this summer, and found that by a large proportion, voters said they would be more likely to vote for Harris, for the Democrat, if that candidate advocated a cutoff of weapons to Israel. And it's not even close. You had more than 30% saying they would be more likely to vote for Harris with advocacy of a cutoff, and only single digits saying they would be less likely. And these were in key swing states. So that's where the political as well as moral unhinged policy is still in place, coming from Harris. And she's playing by the old playbook. This is the old way of doing politics. It's default. We are going to support Israel. We support whatever Israel does. We might do some criticism, but we basically will keep making the killing and the oppression possible. So that's where we are right now.
And what about Trump? I mean, you know, how could his stance on the war in Gaza affect his presidential run?
Well, he seems to just be doing that. He's pressing the standard buttons and he's playing the routine tapes. And so given that in the same speech, he can say diametrically opposite things. For instance, he can criticize U.S. foreign policy as being run by a bunch of wimps and by people who are warmongers. And this is not inconsistent because he doesn't care about consistency at all. In terms of Israel, the Trump campaign is exploiting this, as is their wont. They're running ads in Dearborn, Michigan, and elsewhere with a high portion of Arab Americans, where Muslims live, people who are understandably very upset and angry about U.S. supporting genocide in Gaza. And he's running ads that are sort of push ads saying that Hillary Clinton is a great supporter of Israel and targeting it so carefully that it's going to depress the voting for Harris.
And, you know, I want to now turn back to Harris specifically. And, you know, she's a lawyer, a very accomplished attorney, a seasoned attorney. And one of the things I think is interesting is how she continues to assert this idea that Israel has a right to defend itself when, according to international law, an occupying power actually doesn't have the right to defend themselves against those they are occupying. And actually, those who are being occupied actually have the legal right, according to international law, to resist against the occupation, to resist against any occupation. And in addition to those laws, there are a number of other laws that are being violated by U.S. foreign policy in Israel and by Harris's own stance with respect to Israel and the situation in Gaza. Can you talk about how, with respect to the war in Gaza, the U.S. has actually violated numerous legal requirements, including the U.S. Conventional Arms Transfer Policy, the Foreign Assistance Act, the Arms Export Control Act, the U.S. War Crime Act, the Leahy Law, the Genocide Convention Implementation Act, and several treaties. And we only have 2 minutes for you to do that. I apologize.
Yeah, no problem. Well, I list those laws that the U.S. is violating by arming Israel in the afterword to War Made Invisible. And as you say, these are very clear laws being violated routinely by the U.S. government. You're not supposed to send weapons, according to U.S. law, to countries that are systematically using those weapons or using those weapons at all to violate human rights. And so just to sort of sum up, I think it's very important that we not let up in our insistence that the U.S. must stop aiding Israel as this happens. And I would say that when the Kennard has put forward that Israel is, quote, defending itself, it's absurd. There's nothing that Israel is doing in Gaza that has anything to do with self-defense. It's quite the opposite.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we have been talking today about what little attention Gaza did receive at the debate, how Harris and Trump's stance on Gaza impacts each candidate's presidential run, and what Trump and Harris didn't say about Gaza in the debate, with our guest, Norman Solomon, the National Director of RootsAction.org and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His latest book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, was published in paperback this past week with a new afterword about the Gaza war. Thank you, Norman, so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Nagwa, and thanks to Middle East in Focus for informing people.
Thank you again for all of you, the listeners that join us every week. I also want to thank our fantastic engineer, Gary Baca. Once again, you've been listening to Middle East in Focus. The only reason you can all hear this show is because you, the audience, support it financially. You are the power of independent radio. We thank you and hope you will keep listening and continue to support us. Our theme song is The Overture by Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Negwa Ibrahim, wishing you all light, love, and peace. Thanks for joining us, and have a great rest of your Sunday.
The KPFK elections are underway. to elect delegates to the local station board, we are using single transferable voting, aka choice voting, which provides for proportional representation. Your ballot will include a list of listener candidates.